Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. As shared in part one of her story, Hannah Vanderhorst is a special education teacher and administrator living in Denver, Colorado. Having moved to the city in 2016, just before going through a breakup, Hannah turned to dating apps to expand her social circle and look for potential love. However, an October 2019 date changed her trajectory forever. It was on this date that she became a victim of a serial sexual predator, although she wouldn't find that out until 3.5 years after her assault. Hannah would then join a taxing legal battle to receive justice, witness legal change elicited by her and others' experiences, and work to heal from the trauma. The Broken Cycle Media team is very grateful that Hannah was willing to so selflessly share all that came next for her to bring awareness to our listeners.
I first realized what had happened when I saw his mugshot on the news 3.5 years later. It was a gut punch because the story that was briefly described in the caption was identical to mine. Eventually, I had a meeting set up middle to end of April with one of the detectives at the Denver Police Department. So I went downtown in person and shared my story with the police for the very first time. Additional charges were pressed against him in May of 2023, and those were encompassing all of the charges of all of the other women who had come forward similarly to me in March and April and May of 2023. And he was rearrested on those charges right outside of the courtroom before he was supposed to go in for those original charges. So he had posted bail in February, and then in May, he was unable to post bail at that time. So he has been incarcerated since May of 2023. There were multiple different court hearings that happened throughout summer and fall of 2023. A lot of the court dates ended up changing, but I would receive a notice in the mail every time that there was a motions hearing or a court event that was happening. I also had victims advocates that I worked with a lot who would call me and let me know what was going on. I spoke with the prosecutors directly on the phone very often. Trial was pushed back several times because more and more people kept coming forward. The prosecutors had to really rearrange the angles in which they were taking on this case because it just continued to grow and grow. So trial was originally supposed to happen in March of 2024. It got pushed to mid-July of 2024, which I was originally really devastated by because I had worked myself up so much emotionally in preparation for testimony to be ready to go in March. It ultimately ended up being a good thing, more access to therapy throughout that time. And in the summer, it's a lot quieter at work. when you work in schools than it is during March, which is an extremely busy time of year. So I was able to have more capacity in that sense, but I had to trial prep probably a month or so before trial for a several hour long trial prep session with some of the detectives, the victims' advocates, and the prosecutors who walked me through all of the questions that we would be answering while I was on stand. They asked me to watch those videos in that room with them. I'm watching nude videos of myself in a room with people that I don't know. The lights are all fully lit. It felt very exposing, and so I panicked and couldn't watch those videos in that space. That was trial prep. The defense's side was at one point dead set on getting subpoenas to take all of our cell phones from us. Coming to our houses, coming to our places of work. They went to the school that I used to work at, outing me, first of all, in my professional setting, trying to take my phone as if I had done something wrong. This person was calling my phone, texting me, saying that I was being uncooperative and that this is a legal matter that's not going to go away. I need to meet up with her to give her my phone so that they could search it. My boyfriend was not at home. He was on a work trip during this time. So I'm calling him panicking, like, I'm here alone. What do I do? And he had to walk me through, like, get in your car, drive somewhere that makes sense for you to be at that time, because we didn't know if I was allowed to dodge a subpoena. I don't know how many women they successfully served, but fortunately, they were not able to serve me and they weren't able to take our phones. The judge denied that motion because you have to be looking for something specific. It was so scary and so much victim blaming, and it was horrifying. There were so many nights that I was just pacing back and forth in the house being like, why am I even doing this? Is this even worth it? And it was never a true question in my mind that I would give up. The trial was a 4-week trial. My testimony was in the middle of that process. My boyfriend was there every time that I was in the courtroom. I didn't know whether I wanted him in the room or not during my testimony because I hadn't been so gory with him about all of the details. He just sat right outside the courtroom while I testified, but otherwise he was in the courtroom with us every single day. After you testified, you were able to listen to the rest of the trial, either by going in person or if you were a charged victim, you could log in via WebEx, but nobody else was allowed to access the WebEx space. They were trying to keep it as confidential as possible. I was able to hear the testimonies of several of the women that testified after me. The 11 charged victims, the story was nearly identical for all of us. It really showed that he knew what he was doing. He was doing it on purpose, and that he was essentially hunting women on dating apps. He sought out women who were successful in their careers, mostly blonde women. At the time, I was blonde, who all looked pretty similar. And it makes me think that he was just looking to assert power and domination over women that he probably felt in the real world that he couldn't control without assaulting them. His girlfriend came up and my jaw hit the floor. Because I didn't know until that very moment that she was real. He had said that somebody was living in that apartment with him, but they were in the process of moving out or like breaking up or something like that. It turns out somebody was living there. She actually testified right after me. Basically, she appeared to not know anything about anything. The questions that she answered was very basic, like, about how the apartment was laid out. She did say she was moving out, but she had been his girlfriend for about a year. She didn't seem to have any similar story, and she obviously did not see my testimony because you can't go in the courtroom until after your subpoena is up and after you have testified. Unfortunately, as I was leaving the courtroom, I ended up getting in the elevator with her. And I was like, how is this real right now? She was with her now husband. And I remember hearing her say, like, I just feel so sorry for his mom. She's so sweet. I was like, how did we end up here? The defense's argument was probably exactly what we fear it would be, which is blaming the victims, saying that we were the ones who got too drunk, saying that we were going through things in our lives that caused us to do this to ourselves. For example, this person was going through a divorce at that time, and so that's why this happened to you. You were taking this medication, and so this was the effect that alcohol had on this medication. Really, just there was no defense. Going through trial prep and the trial itself was so hard, and that cannot be understated enough. It's probably a huge deterrent of why people don't come forward, because it is so freaking exhausting to go through. I didn't get to meet the other survivors until trial was finished and while we were waiting for the verdict to come in. I had been wanting to connect with these other women for the year and a half that it took to get to trial. After closing arguments had concluded, they brought us down to this room in the basement of the courthouse that we then became extremely familiar with. Our group chat name is named after that room number in the basement, where we all got to know each other and we got to introduce ourselves and put faces to a name. Some of us talk more than others, but we're definitely all in contact with each other now. We have a very unique connection between us. We met each other in the most unconventional of ways. It feels almost like a sisterhood in that sense. I know that the jurors were obviously extremely invested in this. They gave up a month of their lives in order to sit on this jury. They deliberated, I think it was like 4 days. We got the verdict mid-August. I was in the room when they read the verdict. I had mostly been hanging out in that basement room for a couple days, but of course, the day that they had the verdict, I was at home kind of in a frozen state, like hadn't gotten out of bed yet. And then I get a text like, verdict's in, get down here now. They gave us the first 2 rows of the courtroom and we all sat together. There were so many counts against him. They had to go through them one by one. And it did say the name of the survivor that that count was attached to. So we knew exactly when our counts were going to be coming up as the verdicts were read. My charges, the first one is sexual assault incapable of appraising nature of conduct, sexual assault physically helpless, sexual assault submission against will, and assault in the second degree.
On August 13th, 2024, Stephen Matthews was found guilty on 35 of 38 counts he had been charged with.
I think the heaviness mostly hit after receiving the verdict. Walking out of the courtroom felt surreal. I remember the prosecutors asking me, so what are you guys going to do tonight? And we're like, what do you do after something like this? And that's when I mostly wanted to shut down. Sentencing had to be pushed back for scheduling purposes. And so we didn't have sentencing until October 25th. It was almost 5 years to the day exactly of my original assault. Most of us were in the room for that as well. Several of the jurors returned and were actually in the courtroom sitting near us in support. I didn't know for sure who these people were looking to speak with us afterwards, wanting to hug us. And I'm like, I don't know who they are, but they know my story really, really well. And that was such an interesting thing to think about. His father had the opportunity to speak at sentencing and he blamed it on his alcoholism and said, oh, no, he just needs to go to rehab and then he won't do this anymore. He'll be healed. And I was like, that's not what this is whatsoever. The ultimate sentence that he received was 158 years to life. He is serving time individually for each victim back to back. There were 11 of us. So between like 6 and 12 years per woman. Our judge in his closing statements said, I cannot heal, which is very true. I walked out of the courtroom up to the prosecutors and they were like, any questions? And I was like, yes, what just happened? will he get out is really what I need to know. All of the math, it was really hard to follow because of all of the legal jargon and explanation of each charge being broken up into individual sentences. They explained to me he won't be eligible for parole ever. He would need to admit guilt in order to enter into a sex offender's rehabilitation program, but he's not even eligible for that for like another 40 years. So there's just no way that he would even be able to complete that program within his natural lifespan. And then after sentencing, I felt less of a shutdown, probably because I was expecting to feel so impacted by things that I was more proactive. But living with this understanding that somebody is incarcerated for the rest of their lives, no matter what, is something that does truthfully weigh very heavily on me. I think maybe less so now as it continues to sink in, like the gravity of the situation and how important it is that this person is no longer able to harm others. Justice would be for this to never have happened. Justice would be this personal acknowledgement or an apology. Justice would be a world in which it isn't so painful to prove your experience to a court of peers. Justice is this current fantasy version of reality where sex-based crimes don't occur because of our intrinsic value of ourselves and for each other. And justice is a world ultimately where prisons don't need to exist. I hope that one day those things can be a possibility, but this is the system we're working with right now. And so coming to terms with somebody facing 158 years to life, that is difficult. I have to learn to accept that at the end of the day, the world is a safer place with him not being able to do this ever again. But receiving the verdict, it was a level of validation that I think I ultimately needed to believe myself a little bit more and feel more confident in sharing this story with others. And I think it starts with your friends and family that you share with. I have been able to share my story one by one, starting with my very close circle of friends and expanding it outwards as I see fit, and really picking and choosing who gets that level of access to me. I have done a total 180 in terms of moving from really hiding this story from everyone in my life, including myself, and then being ready to share it with the right platform. This is really my first long interview that I've had. I never spoke with the local news about any of this. Several of the other women have and have had mixed emotional experiences with sharing their story. Sometimes I feel like I want to just scream this story from the rooftops because I held it in for so long and navigated it for so long on my own. The world keeps going when something like this happens, and I kept going. And a lot of people had no clue anything was going on with me at all. And now I'm to the point where I want to be like, this was going on the whole time and nobody knew. So it's this balance of wanting to stand on the rooftops with a megaphone and also sharing with who feels safe for me to share with. Last Friday, I was invited to speak with the police department. I had to ask, are you going to provide me questions ahead of time? And they said, no, we don't really have questions. We eventually like came up with our own questions and gave those to him to answer. I said, I really don't think we need to spend a ton of time talking about exactly what happened. I think I want to center survivors and this call to action to people in the community. I was trying to frame that that was my hope for the interview, but I don't think that that was really their hope for the interview. I sat down in the chair. The cameraman asked me, introduce yourself and give your elevator pitch about what happened. He was like, I know people cope with this in different ways, but you seem happy about it. Can you be a bit more serious? My stomach just dropped, and it's dropping now again as I share this. And I said, okay, so you want me to be more sad? My voice simply is loud and it can be theatrical. I'm a teacher. I am a storyteller. And to tell me to act more serious and sad, it's not a coping mechanism. It's just who I am. And it was shut down. This is exactly what we're talking about here. Survivors present in different ways. And I am not sad. It's been 5 years and I've had so much support and I'm in a different state of processing this. Another one of the questions that he asked me was if I thought this was something that couldn't happen to me. It's something that only happened to other people. And it felt really pointed. But my response was, I never thought that because things like this did happen to me multiple times. And so it seemed normal. The actual issue was that I didn't have an educational understanding of what healthy relationships and healthy dating looks like and believing myself and believing survivors. It felt more like an advertisement for the police department. Come on down, report to us, and you'll go to trial and you'll get your verdict. With my experience with the Denver Police Department, it was more challenging than that. I went home and I shut down for the rest of the day and just felt I need to trust my gut. We are kind of getting our story out there and doing the best we can with the different media outlets that ask us questions with different purposes. But man, it's tough to grapple with because I think I have a lot of helpful things to say, but this platform just didn't feel like a safe place to share who I was authentically. It's complicated. We need more people to come forward because we have to change this precedent. However, to pretend that there isn't so much more work that still needs to be done is not something that I'm okay with. So grappling with that right now, and I just am really hoping that they do justice to the things that I said. The media has a huge amount of power in the way that our stories are told. I would check the news every single day during trial to see what had been reported, and I noticed inaccuracies throughout. And for the most part, they were minor, but it was still difficult to see. The prosecutors and our victims' advocates were always like, don't check the news. Well, of course I'm going to check the news. More and more people came forward because they did see it presented in the media. And so that was helpful to spread awareness and understanding. I listened to Something Was Wrong a lot for years, and I just was like, oh, I appreciate this podcast. And now I understand on a deeper level why. I was listening to it for a purpose. So when people's stories are told, I think that they really need to be held with care and presented in a way that is really, really honoring to the victims. And I think that first person perspective is so important because there's a lot less space for inaccuracies in the retelling of what truly happened and what survivors want to see happen. There was recently an article that came out. Several news organizations came together to do an investigative journalism piece on dating apps and reports that they had received of predators on the apps and their willful ignorance of those people still remaining on the apps and their lack of action over the span of several years to keep people like this off of the apps. The journalists tested a variety of different ways that people could create new accounts or get around reports or looking into reports that were flat out ignored.
A February 2025 article published by NPR highlighted an interview with investigative reporter Emily Elena Dugdale, who worked on the Dating Apps Reporting Project, which was produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center's AI Accountability Network. In the interview, Emily states that serial rapist Stephen Matthews had been reported to a match group app as early as 2020. But was able to continue to use the apps and assault many women for several years following that initial report. According to the article, quote, after he was reported, he was even featured as a standout date on Hinge, which means the app actually promoted his profile to women looking for matches, end quote. A 2024 CBS News article shared that as a result of the crimes committed against Hannah and her fellow survivors, a Denver senator was inspired to create SB 24011. The bill requires dating apps to adopt new processes, which include posting safety policies on their sites and expanding their guidelines for reporting misconduct committed by a member. Under this new bill, dating apps would also have to file annual statements with the Colorado Attorney General's office about reports of misconduct by their members and the consequent actions taken by the app. Additionally, the dating apps would have to reveal the number of members barred each year due to misconduct. The bill was officially passed and became a law on June 5th, 2024.
As a result of our criminal case, the state of Colorado actually passed a new law that is intended to increase tech safety, including dating apps. I haven't been on the apps since 2021. I don't really know what they look like at this point, but there's so many ideas of how to do things better because right now there's not much that's being done. First and foremost, don't allow them to create a new account. We have incredible technology with AI, photo, and facial recognition. There shouldn't be multiple accounts with the same person's face on it showing up after they've been reported. I think not using that technology to do that is really negligent, irresponsible, and dangerous. I also think there needs to be required safety education when you have started to use apps like these. Having little pop-ups maybe on the app when you open it up that are teaching people about what healthy dating looks like or saying, if you experience X, Y, and Z, this is how you can report it. Here's some examples of things that could be reported. Additionally, follow up with people if they have chatted or gone on a date with somebody who has been reported, they should be notified of that. Acting as more of a support for people when they've experienced something traumatic as a result of using their app rather than trying to protect the bottom financial line. Ultimately, it comes down to like they are trying to make money. And so they're also in another lawsuit for gamifying the apps. They don't actually want people to get off the apps. How are they making money otherwise? It doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel ethical. As more and more of these cases come forward and are prosecuted, change will occur, but it's really, really slow. And it starts with these really higher profile cases that have power and privilege. We have to start there and work our way forward from where we're at right now. We have to do better. We got our verdict and other people deserve to have theirs too. What that looks like is believing survivors from the get-go. I want this to be a call to action to the community to take this type of crime and assault very, very seriously. When I think of my own experience of engaging with the Denver Police Department early on in 2019 for a different situation, I wish there had been even just a female officer who was like, are you okay? Let me take you into another room. Like different protocols that are more rooted in care and trauma-informed practices, telling people like, I do have the time for you right now. You know, that's not always possible in this moment, but I'd love to dream for that to be a possibility, to have a lot more resources to be able to center our responses in care rather than triaging. I think every organization would benefit from trauma-informed training because it's about how to interact with other people in a way that's acknowledging your own biases and your responses to circumstances and understanding how you bring those into encounters with other people and how to recognize those triggers and improve the quality of your interpersonal interactions with others. At the end of the day, community has been the most pivotal and supportive to me. My partner has supported me every single step of the way, and our relationship has provided a stability for me in my life that I have not ever experienced. Even if my friends don't necessarily know about what has happened, being able to spend time with them and celebrate the the life that we have looking ahead has been really helpful in getting through. Getting out to the mountains when traffic on I-70 isn't too horrific has been absolutely pivotal to me, especially in 2020. I would drive up to the mountains and I did a lot of solo hiking, solo camping, which sounds so wild, but it allowed me to meet new people outside who were ultimately beautiful connections for me during a time that was really weird. I got through this journey being carried by my therapist, Holly. Shout out to her. She is so incredible. I just am so incredibly grateful for her. And I've been able to financially pay for sessions with her for the last 2 years through the Victims Comp program. I remember seeing online that she specialized in women with anxiety. That fit my bill pretty well at that point. She was part of this therapy collective, which already was a green flag for me. She seemed to be of a similar age to me. So I tried her out and it's gone really, really well. Originally, she had like an income-based slot available. So I qualified for that income-based slot with her. We did 2 sessions on that. And then I had Victims Comp start paying for the rest of those sessions. She doesn't just sit there and listen and nod in agreement with everything. While she is extremely validating, she also will point out things to me that I haven't noticed or will push back on and challenge my understanding. I appreciate that so much. She is trained in EMDR, which I think that was something that I was also looking for. You have to be intentional when looking for a therapist that works for you. It's like shopping around as you would for a new job. Or dating, really. I think you have to have this mindset too of this is a professional. And if I do not vibe with this, then I don't have to continue on. Like you can't be worried about hurting other people's feelings when you're looking for something that is right for you. My background in trauma-informed education really, really helped me to understand coping skills that were specific to me. What does it look like in me when I'm feeling dysregulated? And what do I do to regulate myself in those cases? I want to build awareness around things like this, in particular, recognizing the signs of pain and emotion that live in your body and like trusting your gut and knowing when things aren't right and learning to respect yourself and honor yourself because he did this to me and to us. I did not do anything. But to be able to recognize that this situation was not something that I deserved and this is not something that is okay and learning to fight for yourself in that way. And so that's really what I want to use this story for moving forward and integrate this experience into my life through supporting future generations of people who may experience something similar. You deserve to have your story honored and believed because it is so hurtful when people don't honor your story. Follow your gut, trust your intuition, and share your story with confidence. That is what matters, and you will find people who are supportive to you and can respond and support you in the way that is needed. I'm not saying like only tell people that you feel 100% confident in sharing this with because we have to expand that circle of individuals in order for change to happen. You don't have to do this alone. You can rely on other people and your coping skills to get through. Like I said, I listened to Something Was Wrong for so long, and I think that that really also did help carry me through. And so to be able to be a part of this podcast and talk about this experience with the media and the justice system, now that I've actually been able to get through it, is surreal. And I just appreciate this so, so much.
We could not do this without you and without survivors. We are so beyond grateful for the wisdom and the information and the advocacy that our guests impart. I appreciate you sharing yourself with our audience.
Thank you. It even just means something to one person, then that's great.
thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
We woke up just before dawn. We heard this incredibly loud banging. It felt like it shook the house or like someone was trying to break the door down. He and I jumped out of bed, and when we opened the door, there were all of these FBI agents in their big bulletproof vests, and they had guns drawn. My initial thought was, is there some criminal on the loose? Do they think someone is in our yard or in our house? It did not cross my mind that they were there for us.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.